You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Now, this is pretty unprofessional, but I told you that an Amtrak officer was going to join us. Joining us now is Lee. Lee, I don't even know your last name. What is it?
Adamovich.
Adam Ogert?
Adamovich, yeah. Nice and Polish.
Nice and Polish. The born and raised where?
Raised in Connecticut.
Raised in Connecticut. Where'd you go to college?
I went to the Naval Academy.
You're a Naval Academy guy. Now, you
Correct.
Know you have to pay for that sin, okay? This is the Marine Corps, after all. We're not going to let that go and, without talking about it. Okay, so how does the Naval Academy get on your radar? I mean, that's something that that if you don't do as a relatively young guy, it normally passes you by, but by the time you realize it. How's the Naval Academy get on your radar?
Yeah, it's just something I heard a lot about when I was younger, growing up. I couldn't tell you the origin of it, but it was just a goal ever since I was a little kid.
Now, so do you come from a military family? Connecticut, that's Navy country. What, Groton, the War College is up there?
Yep, we got a War College in Newport, Groton, the sub base. No, not necessarily a military family. Again, it's just it's something that's on every little 4-year-old's, 6-year-old's mind, and I never grew out of it. So,
wow. Well, so so the Naval Academy, how do you hear about the Naval Academy, though? I mean, that's normally an interesting conversation because it's not the normal path. You know, we know, I was a little history dork, and I even did a project like in fifth grade about the Naval Academy, but I never thought about going there. I don't know why. It's kind of stupid. But I was never the brightest bulb in the chandelier. How does the idea of actually going there come to you?
That was just conversations. I had a couple other friends when I was growing up, in junior high school and early years of high school, and we talked about always doing it together. And we kind of pretty competitive, so we were competing with each other in that respect. And yeah, I just that's where I ended up.
Got it. All right. What's the best part about going to the Naval Academy?
I'd say so far, the 5.5 years since I graduated, it's just been the people, the relationships and the kind of the network that you build while you're there has been, the strongest. Obviously, the education is pretty phenomenal, but, it's no better than any other good college or university in the country. So I would just say it's the people.
Got it. All right. So you come from Connecticut. You're at the Naval Academy. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
So obviously the Marine Corps falls under the Department of the Navy, so it's a pretty pretty clear path on graduation. I think there's about 270 or so of us in my graduating class that went to the Marine Corps. And for me, it just kind of, when I grew up, I was big into the outdoors. The Marine Corps just kind of lined up with a lot of my values and a lot of things that I like to do.
So when you went there, was it your intention to join the Marine Corps, or did it evolve during your time at Annapolis?
It was definitely what I wanted to do, but that desire only got a lot stronger when I was surrounded by, the Marine officers that they had there at the Naval Academy.
Yeah, that tends to be a pretty tight crew, yes?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so you head down to the basic school, and how do you find your way into those behemoth vehicles known as Amtraks? How does that happen?
My SPC was an Amtraker, prior to that, during the summer training that we had to do in college, I remember during Marine Week, we spent some time on AAVs, and I just, you know, I thought they were the coolest thing in the world. So, you know, that's how I ended up as an AAV officer.
Wow. Wow. So, you know, I don't normally allow it, but I feel the need for one of us to say it, right? You ain't tracked, you ain't shit. Okay. So, so that's how the Amtrak community rolls across the Marine Corps. If you're ever down at Camp Del Mar, down by the boat basin, you will see it painted very gloriously still on a Quonset hut. And you'll see it other places that they're very proud of. So you get assigned to what it's first tracks out of Pendleton, right?
Third tracks.
Hey,
yep.
Where are first tracks?
So right now it's the second tracks in Camp Lejeune and third tracks in Camp Pendleton.
And there is no first tracks.
Right.
Okay. All right. The one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. And was to, I mean, obviously, much in the news is the accident that happened to the 15th MU. And I won't, as everybody who listens to this program knows, we don't speculate because that's not what we do. But you know, a lot of people don't understand, you know, how they work, emergency procedures, how things are supposed to happen. And Amtrak's have an incredible record of safety. I was talking to a friend of mine. Got out as a colonel the other day, infantry officer, opso on a MU, and he was saying, you know, Mac, in my lifetime, he said, I can only recall two accidents other than the one that happened a few years ago in the boat basement at Pendleton.
Right.
And he said, you know, so the record, I mean, because we use them all over the world every day. And so, what I'd like to do with you, Lee, is just have you explain, you know, some of the things that we don't have. And so I'll tee them up and then you can whack them. First of all, explain if you could, the bilge system to us, right? The system that pumps water, because it is a seagoing thing, and there are parameters before you all get in the water. But, you know, the ocean being the uncooperative beast that it is, sometimes, you know, the wind whips up, you know, waves whip up or whatever. How does the vehicle deal with water that it takes on?
Yeah. So the vehicle itself has four bilge pumps. In total, it can pump out, 440 gallons of water per minute. And the system, it's actually really two systems. So two of those bilge pumps are electrical, and then the other two are hydraulic. So, you know, that gives you some redundancy if there were to be a hydraulic failure or if there were to be a electrical failure, you know, you still have two running bilge pumps. So that's the redundancy there. Both of those systems are tested every time before the vehicle gets in the water, so that you know, before you leave the ship, before you leave the beach, that your systems are working.
Got it. And so, obviously, for something like this has to happen, you have to have failure of both systems.
Correct. Or you know, there would have to be a leak that is, you know, more water is coming in than what it can pump out.
Got it. Okay. What about the talk to us about so when a vehicle is under duress, how do you get out? I mean, so there's three hatches, right? There's the there's a vehicle commander, there's a driver, and then there's a troop commander. So there's hatches for those three, and so why don't you explain the hatch system and how those guys talk, and then we'll talk about what goes on in the back of the vehicle.
So you're correct. There's those three main hatches. There's also two cargo hatches that run the full length of the troop compartment in the back. Communication is all done through an intercom system, and again, there's strict SFP is in place. The intercom system has to be working before a vehicle can get into the water. So the vehicle commander, the troop commander, and the driver, as well as the rear crewman in the back, are all able to to talk to each other and pass information about what's going on with the vehicle.
Explain the crew on the vehicle itself. Is the vehicle commander, and is he the gunner as well? Is he shooting the up gun station?
That's correct. The vehicle commander is the turret.
Got it. And so then you have the driver. You have the troop commander that's got a hatch, and then would it be the crew chief is in back?
We call them the rear crewman, and the rear crewman is on a jump seat, and he's positioned right by the rear hatch, that door, just to make sure that he can keep an eye on all the troops, and if anything weird starts happening in the back of the vehicle, he can either stop it or pass it up to the vehicle commander.
Got it. So he's going to be on that intercom system, talking to them, relaying what's going on in the back.
Correct. Okay.
Explain the egress system when, as you said, either you're taking on too much water that you can pump out, or it might be some combination of your systems are degraded and you're taking on too much water. So explain, before we do that, explain the flotation device. So Marines are back there, they've got their gear on. What kind of flotation device do they wear? How do they wear it? And is it capable of holding them up with all their gear on?
Yeah, so we wear personal flotation devices, just like a life vest, with a CO2 cartridge for inflation. So they're not inflated while you're wearing it. That goes on over the gear, and it's absolutely, we test it capable of floating a Marine with gear.
So it goes on... kind of like the thing that goes over your head and sits around your neck, and then the other piece ties it or fastens around your waist.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. And that can, so a Marine with their PPE on, that'll keep you up in the water.
Yeah, that's correct.
Wow. Wow. And next question. I know that my son, when he was part of the Mew, one of the things that their life vest had was what are they called? Like a NALC bottle, but it's a little oxygen bottle. Do yours have those oxygen bottles?
Yeah. So it kind of seems more hit or miss on those. What it was is a small little black cylinder with a mouthpiece, and you could get maybe 2 minutes of breathing air out of it. And I've seen him on the 31st Mew, but a lot of times during training, especially routine training when it's just the AAV crews, those really haven't been issued.
Got it. Okay.
But I do know, so I can't speak for the case of the 15th Mew, but I know the Mews typically use them.
Got it. No, the Mews, because they're... real world contingency things, there's a difference between that, the way we train and the way we go to war, and the Mews normally are pretty well stocked with stuff like that. Talk about when something does happen, what does emergency egress look like for the vehicle? And if you wouldn't mind, start in the front. What are their responsibilities? Because if you're the vehicle commander, that's your vehicle, and your job isn't to be the first one out of the vehicle. Your job is to make sure that thing's evacuated safely, right? And the crewmen all have roles in all of that.
Right. So I would say it would start in the back. So the rear crewman is keeping an eye on that water level. Right. And as soon as it gets to the trigger point, which is usually if water is at the height of, the bench seat is when they're going to, so he's passing information obviously up well before then, but that's the trigger that, hey, it's time to egress now. So he's going to signal that up to the vehicle commander and the driver, and they're going to then come to the top of the vehicle. The starboard cargo hatch, which, as I said, that runs the entire length of the troop compartment, that's going to be opened up, and that can be opened up from the inside. And then there's a we call it the radio cage. It's basically a ladder that helps you climb to the top of the vehicle and out of that cargo hatch.
Right.
The way it's supposed to work is you have the vehicle commander and the driver up there helping Marines get onto the top of the vehicle. And then, you know, given the conditions, they're either going to transfer to another vehicle or jump into the ocean off the port side of the vehicle.
Okay.
So they'll climb out on top, get onto the still closed port cargo hatch, and they'll disembark from there.
Okay, and it's the port cargo hatch, so it's on the left-hand side of the vehicle, and you can open that from inside, and the rear crewman would be responsible for opening that and beginning that process.
Right. So they're also, they give a brief to all the embarked troops that are in the back prior to departure. So they've all identified emergency egress points. It can be dark back there as well. Those handles have glowing chem sticks on them, so they can be identified in the darkness as well. So it's pretty easy to spot them. Everyone in the back has been briefed, like, hey, if we're going to egress, this is exactly what you do. So they know beforehand, and that rear crewman's not trying to
instruct
them in a chaotic environment.
Got it. What about talk to me you've been a member of the 31st MU. I mean, when you have a habitual relationship with a company, you guys do this, right? Dry land training, right? I mean, and it gets to be pretty monotonous and rote, but it's part of what we do to make sure these kind of things don't happen. Explain the training that you do. I mean, you would have been in charge of as a platoon commander to make sure that the guys that are in the back understand the safety system, the evacuation system, and that we go drill this thing before we ever go out in the water. Explain how you guys do that.
Yeah, so I will say, you know, before I get myself in trouble, I wasn't ever part of the 31st MU, but I was out there in Okinawa twice. I had a pretty close relationship with both of those 31st MU platoon commanders.
Got it.
It comes down to onshore familiarization training. A lot of the times, those infantry companies are pretty, at least the leadership, they're pretty eager to come down and, you know, get their Marines on the vehicle. And so we'll do it as many times as they want to come down, get on the vehicles. We'll do egress training on dry land, so they all have experience with egressing a vehicle before it's even in the water. Additionally, we do what we call surf qualifications. So we'll take the vehicle out into the water with all the troops embarked, and then go out maybe 200 to 500 meters. Have all the Marines disembark and swim to shore. So, you know, they've actually practiced doing that in the water as well.
Got it. And that's all part of the qual, walk, run system that we tend to use in
absolutely
in everything we do. Because as people know, I don't care if you're talking about, you know, tanking on an F-18, I don't care if you're talking about gun runs out in the desert. I don't care if you're talking about, just fording, you know, going across a bridge at night if you're an LAV, right? There's a way that we tend to do it, and it is very much crawl, walk, run because, even though these things don't happen, I mean, when I could tell, you know, and Lee, you can comment on this, when you're responsible for the lives of other people, life gets serious, you know, as much as Marines like to joke around and screw around, life gets incredibly serious when we begin to do this stuff.
Absolutely. I think the best examples of where I've seen that was prior to water operations with AAV that, you know, those Marines, they never failed to take that incredibly seriously.
Got it. Now, let me ask you, and I don't know the answer to this because I'm not I was an LAV company commander. I'm not so familiar with AAV. If the port-side cargo hatch If some for some reason we can't get that open, then what?
So it's yes, the starboard side cargo hatch. I couldn't name a scenario where that wouldn't be able to be opened unless the vehicle sank really quickly.
Okay. So let me ask you this. So, and this is just me being stupid, but when you say cargo hatch, that's that long, the whole hatch. There isn't a hatch within that hatch that sits above the radio rack that we're going to go out.
No.
Okay. So it's that the left side. That's that left side panel.
Yep.
Got it. So if for some reason that we can't get that open, we throw open the right side.
Yeah. So you can. I mean, it's not one of those systems where you can't open the left until you open the right. You know, you can open, if that were to be stuck, then yes, you could absolutely open the other side. The only reason that we say to open the right side first is that's where the radio cage is, and that's where you can climb out easily from. But where there could be an emergency, yeah, there's that second.
Okay. And this came up the other day, but knowing the inherent danger in operating on the ocean, is there a reason that we would travel with those hatches closed, knowing that it is difficult, or it might be difficult under duress to open that stuff?
I think it's another one of those give and takes. I think you prevent, especially if it's rough seas. You know, it's not. It's not rare, I should say, to have like a wave come up over the bow. So I think, you know, we leave them closed just to keep a lot of water out in the first place.
Got it. So the normal way to travel is with them closed.
Yes, that's correct.
Got it.
The three hatches, the vehicle commander, the driver, and the troop commander, those are opened up after you disembark the ship or after you've left the surf zone on the beach. Those are safe to be opened up.
Okay. So those you enter the water, be it whether you splash from a well deck or you leave from the beach, you enter with those things button up and then those things go open.
Enter and exit, completely buttoned up.
Got it. What about, the rear hatch on the vehicle. If you're in the back and for whatever reason, somebody told me that if there's more than 3 meters of water above that hatch, the cargo hatches, you can't get them open. Is that true?
Yeah, just with, you know, because of the weight of the water,
right.
You would not be able to open that.
Okay. And so, is there any way does the rear hatch, so in an emergency, if the cargo hatches are non-functional or we can't, for whatever reason, we can't open them, is there any recourse to the back of the vehicle?
So the way that we train in the egress trainer, which is a big, mock AAV on a crane that they, you know, they drop it in a pool,
right,
and you practice this egress. You're supposed to wait until that vehicle is settled and stops sinking. You know, if you've sunk and if you're sinking and you can't get the hatches open, what they teach you to do is, you know, to wait until it stops sinking, and wherever it lands, the orientation, you would then attempt to open that hatch. Either the rear hatch or the cargo hatch at that point.
Right.
It's kind of grim to think about it that way, but, you know, it's the safest way. It doesn't work very well. The outcome is not good in really deep water.
Got it. The, all right. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about, you know, operating this thing that, as I said, in my lifetime, which spans since like 1983 in the Marine Corps, I can only remember two incidents like this happening. exceedingly rare. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about AAV operations that without which this thing won't be complete?
I think, you know, we hit all the big ticket things, you know, the redundancy and the build system. I think it's just really important to reiterate, you know, what you just said. I've seen a lot of obviously with this absolute tragedy, a lot of the comments on social media, you know, saying this happens all the time, you know, we need to cancel all the AAVs. It's, you know, it just doesn't happen all the time. The track record of safety is incredible. And most of that's just a testament to the AAV community and their ability to maintain and keep these vehicles up in good condition.
The other thing that you said that I don't think a lot of people know is that those systems are tested every time.
That probably is a good thing to touch on. You know, in the well deck or on the beach, prior to, you know, even if you just say you just came out of the water and you're about to get right back in because you're training, that vehicle is going to be tested again by the senior enlisted AAV. Usually the platoon sergeant is going to lead a team of three Marines through every vehicle, and they're going to check the hold plug, make sure they're still screwed in. They're going to check the bilge pumps. They're going to check all the hatches to make sure they're closed and locked. And it's monotonous and it takes a long time, but it happens every time without fail. And it's conducted by, you know, by SFD. It's the senior 1833, the senior Amtraker there.
And the senior Amtraker is charged specifically, that person's charged with specifically making sure that those checks are done.
Yep, and, you know, if he's not conducting it himself, he's watching his team of two Marines conduct it on each individual vehicle.
Got it. One of the other things that Colonel Kenny talked to me about was, he said, you know, the most dangerous part of operating Amtraks, now this is him as an op, so not as an Amtraker, he said, was when they transition in the water, they transition from, you know, their land-based drive system to their seaborne drive system. I don't understand, you know, if there's two separate systems. Is that true? Is there any time that you as a platoon commander, you as a vehicle commander, this is the thing I got to pay attention to, as you know, because if problems happen, normally they begin here. Is there any part when the vehicle's more vulnerable? And I say that because as an LAV company commander, those things were pretty typical and they were day-to-day things, but the redundancy in the system was built to account for that. I use his word vulnerable. I use that with quotation marks because it's vulnerable in the sense of there's three other systems that back this up. So I ask you that. Is there anything that you pay a lot of attention to as you go either splash or go feet wet from feet dry?
So the three different modes that the AAV can operate in are land, we call it water tracks. So basically water operation, but you're still utilizing the tracks to drive, and then just straight water where it's all using the water propulsion system. So before you splash, you're already in that water mode. So transitioning, there's really not a lot of transition that happens there once you enter the water. Generally, I think the things that you start looking for as a platoon commander that make you want to pay attention a lot more is when you start having vehicles that have issues. It's pretty common have a vehicle lose steering or have an electrical issue. But again, there's the redundancy built in. If you have an electrical issue or a hydraulic issue, your bilge pumps you're still working with 50% of your bilge pump power, which is generally more than enough.
Right.
But
All right. Well, first of all, Lee, I just wanted to thank you for coming on and doing this. And I hope in the future, if you don't mind, if we have more questions as the investigation unwinds, that you won't be opposed to coming back on. And again, it's not for us, it's not for me or anybody else I've been on the program to cast judgment or be critical, but I think a lot of people want to understand the circumstances that these things happen under. And I hope in the future, if I need a smart Amtraker, you wouldn't mind coming on. I mean, you are a Naval Academy guy. Come on.
No, absolutely.
All right. And anybody's looking to hire a financial services professional in the San Diego area, send me an email. I'll put you in touch with Lee because he's just transitioned out of the Marine Corps and he's looking to make his first million in that business. So Lee, again, all the best of luck to you. Thank you for being an articulate spokesman for your community. And like everybody, our thoughts and prayers, you know, with the Marines and the sailor that we lost from our community. And I just really want to thank you for coming on and doing this and being a pro.
No, thank you. Thank you for what you do.
That is Captain Lee Adamowicz, United States Marine Corps, former Amtrak officer by way of the United States Naval Academy. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.